Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and I'm delighted to welcome today's guest, Professor Steve Westerby. Steve and I crossed paths, shall we say, a number of years ago at the Royal Postgraduate Medical School, Hammersmith Hospital in London, where I did some of my surgical training. But Professor Westerby was on a very different and truly astral trajectory. Steve obtained a Bachelor of Science with honours in biochemistry from the University of London. His medical degree is also from the University of London, a PhD in bioengineering from the University of Strathclyde, and he's a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons. He served as consultant cardiac surgeon at the John Radcliffe Hospital, Oxford, and at the Royal Brompton Hospital Trust in London, as well as a professor of biomedical engineering at the University of Swansea. He's published more than 350 peer-reviewed publications, has authored or edited 15 books, and was designated appropriately a pioneer of cardiology by the American Heart Association. Professor Westerby has been awarded the Ray C. Fish Award for Scientific Achievement, has personally performed more than 11,000 open heart surgeries on adults and children, and trained numerous surgeons around the world. And those are just some of his achievements. We'll cover some more in this conversation. Steve, welcome.
Thank you very much, and good morning. You certainly laid it on fairly thick there. It made me sound a very boring character, if you don't mind.
Well, as I said, I think we just touched on the surface. But I tell you what, let's go back to medical school.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of your, you know, the pivotal episodes there, your best or interesting memories.
Well, I was very lucky to be there at all, I would have said. I was brought up in the back streets of a northern steel town. I was single-minded. I didn't know it, but I had attention deficit disorder at the time. But I could hyper-focus. And for various reasons, I decided very early on in life that I wanted to be a heart surgeon. So I got down to Charing Cross Hospital Medical School. And one of the first things I wanted to do was actually see a heart operation. And I pestered and I asked the hall porter in the medical school where I could find somewhere where I could watch heart surgery.
Was this just, you were at medical school already, or you were sort of...
Yeah, I just got to the medical school, and we were sat in lecture theatres, and I got bored very easily. And so I set out to try and find a viewing gallery where I could watch surgery. And eventually I did, and it was right on top of the old hospital, which overlooks the Strand. It's now a police station. And the porter said, don't go into the main entrance. They won't let you in. Sneak in through the casualty entrance. You'll find a lift and up you go. And I did. It was a Wednesday afternoon, and they were coming towards the end of a heart operation there. And I was the only one in the viewing gallery, and I switched on an intercom and was quite mesmerized by what I heard. Basically, it was a young woman who was having a mitral valve replaced, and they couldn't get the poor girl off the bypass machine. Made it worse that she was a young mother. And they were pushing in adrenaline. The anaesthetists were getting anxious and shifting from foot to foot. And eventually, they got the blood pressure up. And it went up, and it went up with the adrenaline. And as I was looking down onto the heart, the cannulation site in the aorta gave way, and blood just sprayed the operating lights, came up towards me, and covered the surgeons, covered the nurses, and the girl exsanguinated. So that was my first exposure to cardiac surgery, and I stayed in that viewing gallery and watched them lay the girl out, and thought very carefully about the implications of all that. A child in the East End had become an orphan, and she was on her way to the mortuary. And I was tempted to go and watch the autopsy a couple of days later, but didn't. Now, later on in medical school, it was quite clear that to get on, you had to play rugby. And I hadn't played rugby in Scunthorpe. It was a soccer town. but I had to learn to play rugby. And strangely enough, I got to be quite good at it.
Can I just interpose here, Steve, because yeah. we have an international audience. And, you know, as an Englishman who lived in America, I always resisted calling it soccer and said it's proper football. You know, we use a ball and we use our feet.
Yeah.
And the joke about rugby and soccer or football is that football is a game played by gentlemen and watched by hooligans, and rugby is a game played by hooligans and watched by gentlemen. Would you agree with that?
I would. The medical school team was just full of hooligans.
And so nothing's changed, really.
in the 1960s, the London hospitals had top-class teams. In fact, the captain of England rugby was a medical student at one stage. And we used to go out of London, and we had tours in Cornwall, which were great drinking events. And on one cold winter's day with a frost, I ran out on the pitch, and I was, you know, very energetic, running around, chasing the ball. And I ended up with a very serious head injury. I was knocked out. I was left face down in a puddle of water by my caring medical student colleagues and started to asphyxiate. And I didn't come around for quite a long time in the changing room. But instead of taking me to hospital, they took me to the bar, and I had a few pints. And cut a long story short, the following day was really sick, with raised intracranial pressure and so on and so forth.
My goodness. Did you have surgery?
No, I didn't have surgery, but I was in hospital for a while, and they transferred me back to London, where I was in Charing Cross Hospital for some further days. But what they noticed was the shy, introverted backstreet kid from Scunthorpe had had a complete personality change. Within 3 months, I was the social secretary, organizing the dances and the balls. I compared the Christmas show, and I became very extrovert. And it's quite significant that I believe that single event, the head injury, gave me a surgical personality.
Isn't that interesting? Because, of course, traumatic brain injury can cause sort of frontal syndromes, disinhibition, can't it? It's quite a common occurrence.
I lost fear and I lost inhibition. There's an equivalent in psychology history. A guy called Phileas Fogg, who had a tamping iron go through his frontal lobes when he was laying a railroad in North America. And he completely lost inhibitions and ended up in prison. I didn't end up in prison. I ended up being a frontline surgeon. But I guess it was a narrow path between the two.
Yes, it truly is. Well, you know, those of us who've had the privilege of practicing surgery, this concept of the surgical personality, you know, I have friends who are, you know, there's a friend of mine who's a very prominent pathologist, and he has a surgical personality, and I couldn't square that particular circle, only to discover that he'd wanted to be a surgeon, but he had back problems. And I think there's truth in stereotype. So tell me, you've told us of that very trying experience you had of watching this poor lady succumb during what is, after all, a very serious operation, right? So what was it that steered you towards cardiac surgery? Because that equally might have steered you away from it, really.
Well, the case could have steered me away from it, but I was so set on what I was gonna do, and having become an acquired psychopath through the head injury, I was a very determined character. I was brought up across the road from my grandparents, as happened in steel towns in the old days, and when I was very young, around about 5 to 7 years old, I used to walk the dog with my grandfather, who was just 60. And one day we were out walking around the steel, the slag tips from the steel mills, and he fell to his knees and clutched his chest and went very pale. And he was having his first heart attack. And it took a good half hour before I could get him to his feet again and bring him home.
How old were you at the time, Steve?
I was seven then.
Boy, that's...
This happened a couple of other times. And he got worse. He got short of breath, eventually short of breath at rest. Eventually, he couldn't lie flat in bed. His ankles swelled, so he couldn't put on shoes. His belly swelled, so he couldn't fasten his belt. And things went from bad to worse. He had profound heart failure. And one day I was coming home from school, and the GP's black Austin Healey was parked outside the door. And I knew there was something going on. The curtains were drawn and so on. So I went around the back of the house and sneaked in silently. And I witnessed my grandfather dying from pulmonary edema with bloodstained froth pouring from his mouth and nose. And that was a terrible thing. My mother was there. My grandmother was there. They didn't know I was watching, and I slipped out just after his head slumped on his shoulder and he was blue and he'd gone. But I never forgot that. And I decided at the age of seven, perhaps naively, when you're a backstreet kid from Scunthorpe, that I really wanted to be able to help. And I thought the only thing I could do was to try and get to be a heart surgeon. And there were very few heart surgeons in the country at the time, and nobody from my family had ever been to a university. Mm-hmm. So I was single-minded about it and got on and did it.
Well, I think the world is very pleased that you did. But again, what a traumatic experience to go through. Now, during your training, you eventually found yourself at the Brompton, which again, for our international audience, is a very, very prominent and famous hospital in London. What were the early days like there?
Well, the first thing I realized, having got there, was that cardiac surgeons were larger than life characters. Everybody looked up to them. Everybody was frightened of them. I seem to fit in quite well, unfortunately, perhaps.
I don't think you're scary.
I was sort of the resident surgical officer to the pediatric cardiac surgeon and to an irascible 6'6" German surgeon called Matt Paneth. These were very, very good surgeons. But the mortality rate in those days was pretty damn terrible. I mean, one in four patients wouldn't make it. And I was always the guy that was sent out by my pediatric boss to tell the poor parents and the relatives that their child had died. He wouldn't do it. He didn't want to be exposed to the trauma, to the stress. If you have to go into an operating theatre every day and operate on a child's heart, that's an aspect of it that some people can well do without. Anyway, I got used to that, and in a dusty old cupboard in the operating theatres, I found Lord Brock's boots. And Lord Brock was the guy that really got cardiac surgery started in the UK at the end of World War II. He was an irascible character. He became president of the Royal College of Surgeons and, as I say, eventually Lord Brock. And I used to stomp around the operating theatres in his boots with the ambition of being a good cardiac surgeon myself. And in actual fact, those boots eventually saved my bacon. It was a Saturday night, two nights before Christmas, on the Fulham Road down Chelsea Way. And the Brompton didn't have an accident department. So when things went quiet at night and at the weekends, we didn't expect to get called to do anything. But on that Saturday night, there was a call from Mr. Paneth to say, there's an American Air Force jet coming in from Iceland with a young man who has a ruptured aorta after a motorcycle accident. And I'm going to take this patient to theatre and we're going to repair the aorta, so get things ready, please. And he was out at a Christmas party. Now, myself and the senior registrar at the time, we'd been in the pub. for a couple of hours, and I'd had several pints. And being the rugby guys, the senior registrar was a Welshman. We were used to drinking. It didn't affect us cerebrally, but what it did was, of course, affect me down below. And I thought to myself, gosh, if I'm going to be stood for several hours with the irascible Panath in theatre after five or six pints of beer, I'm going to be in trouble. So what can I do? And I thought of catheterizing myself. I did not want to lose face. I was a young man, very ambitious, and I did not want to have to put my hand up and keep leaving the operating theatre. But I didn't fancy shoving a catheter up there. So I went to the geriatric ward, and I got some Paul's tubing, which is rubber tubing. Long strips of rubber tubing for incontinent men. And I got this tubing. I changed into my theatre gear and led the tubing from my private parts down the trouser leg into Lord Brock's boot. And so I stood there earnestly in theatre, assisting the best I could, whilst my senior registrar colleague was shifting from foot to foot, looking distinctly uncomfortable. And eventually, after about an hour and a half, he had to say, Mr. Panath, do you mind if I go out for a minute? Which he did. And I went to the first assistant's place. And then he came back, and after about another three quarters of an hour, Mr. Panath, do you mind if I go out again? And he went out, and as I was first assisting, Panath said to me, Westerby, he's been drinking, hasn't he? And I said to Mr. Panath, I honestly don't know about that, Mr. Panath. I've been in the library all night. So I was literally filling Lord Brock's right.
Filling his boots. I will never hear that expression without thinking of that story, Steve. So moving across, you've mentioned the U.S. Air Force. What influence did training, the American training have on your career?
I decided I did general surgery at Cambridge, and I love Cambridge. Cambridge was wonderful, and I worked with Roy Khan and several distinguished surgeons. And then I went to the Hammersmith Hospital in London to do cardiac surgery. And I started to get bored. And this, as I say, attention deficit disorder, I believe. And I started to get bored because there was a senior registrar who wanted to operate, and I wanted to operate, and we didn't see eye to eye. So I said, I want to go to America to train. And I did. They sent me there because I was completely undisciplined. And there was a famous cardiac surgeon called John Kirkland who started the whole thing off. He was the first person to use cardiopulmonary bypass successfully at the Mayo Clinic. And I was sent to him. He'd by then moved to the University of Alabama in Birmingham. And I was sent to him to learn discipline. But what happened when I got there was that he was still concerned that the interaction of blood with foreign surfaces was causing damage. It was called the post-perfusion syndrome. And he learned that, he'd heard that I was a difficult character and needed handling fairly carefully, but B, I'd already got a degree in biochemistry. So he put me onto the project to try and find out what caused the damaging effects of cardiopulmonary bypass. And at the same time, the Scripps Institute in San Diego had just produced assays for C3A and C5A, the complement and aflatoxins. So putting two and two together, I thought that the damaging effects of cardiopulmonary bypass were an inflammatory response to the foreign materials of the bypass machine. So I measured complement activation in patients on bypass. And sure enough, the ones that got the worst post-perfusion syndrome had very high levels of complement and aflatoxins in their blood. What's more, at the end of the bypass period, as many as 50% of circulating white blood cells were trapped in the lungs. And I subsequently, when I got back to the Hammersmith, showed that they were releasing protease enzymes and free radicals causing pulmonary edema. Anyway, Kirkland was very pleased with that discovery. And at night, I used to operate all day with them. All day I would operate because I wanted to see as much American surgery as I possibly could. But at night, I used to go to the lab and break down the components of the bypass circuit and incubate them with blood. And what I found was certain materials, nylon in particular, activated complement. And when Kirkland told the manufacturers about that, they removed nylon from the circuit, and that transformed the safety of cardiopulmonary bypass. So I kind of started off my career with an important discovery that saved so many lives, far, far many than the patients I ever operated on. And of course, Kirkland was delighted that we'd made a great discovery. I went on lecture tours to cardiac surgical units in the States, and I became even more, if you like, big-headed and uncontrollable when I actually went to America. And I, as I say, I carried the research on when I got back. But it was during that time in the US that the great Dr. Cooley in Houston implanted only the second total artificial heart.
Well, we're going to come on to that because I know that's an area that you've done some work on. But I'd like to sort of follow your career through. Steve, I was very privileged to have a visiting professorship at Oxford, and I would look longingly at those dreaming spires, as Matthew Arnold styled the city with its gorgeous architecture. And for anyone who hasn't been, go. It's gorgeous. How did you find yourself in Oxford?
Well, one thing about me was that I was seen to be a natural operator. I was ambidextrous, and I just saw anatomy in three dimensions. But as a trainee and a senior registrar at the Hammersmith and Great Ormond Street, I had a reputation for being a bit headstrong. It was the head injury. Aggressive, and you know, I could operate on anything from newborn infants to the elderly, having had the experience in America. And I was warned many times that I'd never get a job in London because, you know, basically people found me so objectionable that they wouldn't want to risk their private practices. And it turned out that Oxford, having watched Cambridge and Papworth develop heart transplant programs and so on and so forth, decided that they should do cardiac surgery. And there were no senior colleagues in Oxford. And needless to say, they wanted somebody that could do hearts in adults, hearts in babies, thoracic surgery and everything else. So I basically applied, and I was very keen on coming to the Dreaming Spires. I'd loved Cambridge when I trained there, and I thought Oxford would be just a great place to have a career. And I was very lucky. Many consultants applied for the job, but they gave it to a senior registrar, a madman probably. I got the job and came to Oxford, and I was very proud.
And when you got there, it was a very small caseload, right, as you've intimated, and you grew the practice pretty massively. How did you, obviously being a fine surgeon is one thing, and we've already established that you're not an introvert, you're not a shrinking violet, but what other things led to the practice growing?
There's a single word I hope characterizes my whole career, and that's innovation. When I came to Oxford, there were no facilities. There'd be an ENT surgeon, a delightful chap called Alf Gunning, doing a handful of cases. And between cases, he used to go out to a college and play squash. So it was very, very low key. there were no dedicated ward beds, there were no dedicated ITU beds. Various people in the team did both general surgery and bits of cardiac surgery. So it was never going to work the way I wanted it to work. So perhaps the pivotal thing was that I just decided I was going to remove everything from the general side. So I set up an ITU, a small recovery area in part of the operating theatres. I got a dedicated team of very good nurses. I got the anaesthetists to change anaesthetic protocols so patients could wake up straight away. And on the condition that we'd improved the safety of cardiopulmonary bypass by changing the materials, I said, you know, why ventilate patients in an intensive care unit after cardiac surgery if it's unnecessary? The habit was that every patient after cardiac surgery spent the night in an intensive care unit asleep and being kept asleep. I decided to wake everybody up and extubate them straight away. And in that recovery area, we had an average extubation time of less than 2 hours for aortic valves, less than 2 hours for coronary bypass, and even less than 4 hours for mitral patients who were a bit sicker. And a lot of the patients went to the ordinary ward in the afternoon, and we had discharge times from hospital of 3 or 4 days and no longer. So that changed the economics of cardiac surgery. And people came from all over the world to see how we did that. Nobody believed it. American units sent whole teams to learn how we did it. Mm-hmm. But we changed stuff. And by increasing productivity, it allowed me to develop major aortic surgery, which we did for huge parts of the country and abroad. And then I started pediatric open heart surgery. Because the Oxford started to cotton on that, you know, if we can do these things, we might as well do them well and become a frontline unit. And we went from less than 100 cases to 1,600 cases a year in less than 10 years with just three surgeons. It generated waves. Needless to say, made me massively unpopular with certain people. I actually spent so much money in the first 3 months I was in Oxford that they closed me down. And the day they closed me down, I was asked to go and operate in Saudi Arabia. So I did, and said, call me when you've got more money.
You know, it's interesting to hear you tell this story, Steve, because, you know, in the recent past in general surgery, the concept of enhanced recovery after surgery, ERAS protocols, are all the news. And it's like, well, you know, other people have been, we have many firmly held beliefs, don't we, in surgery. We're always certain and sometimes right, but good for you for challenging it. So I want to go back to maybe putting two and two together, but the story you told of seeing your grandpa die from cardiac failure. Did that play a role in drawing you towards mechanical circulatory support and artificial hearts and all the other things you've done?
It certainly did. You know, I used to know Christian Barnard and Norman Shumway, and I worked in both Papworth and Harefield, the two principal cardiac transplant sites in Great Britain. I had reservations about cardiac transplantation. The results never seemed to be as good as people believed. And indeed, only 40% of the patients reach 10 years survival. And a lot of them are troubled by rejection, infection, cancer, and so on, the sequelae of immunosuppression. And I kind of firmly believe that no treatment that required another young person to die first was ever going to be mainstream. So I wanted to go another way. And you'll recall that I seen Dr. Cooley in his Total Artificial Heart in Houston. I didn't think Total Artificial Hearts were ever going to be any good anyway, but I kept in touch with Houston. And Houston used to bring me devices to Oxford that the FDA wouldn't let them use in America. And I think everybody knows that Europe used to test devices on patients before they'd be licensed in the United States. Now, that was okay. That was okay. But there had to be a better way. And I met a famous artificial heart engineer, Robert Jarvik, by accident at a meeting in San Antonio. And after I'd been asked by a company to look at a device he'd made to perfuse ischemic legs, and I didn't think much of the device. I thought it would clot and so on. And at the end of that conversation, when the rest had gone, he said, "Come up to my hotel room. I've got something interesting to show you." Now,
that's an interesting line, isn't it?
Yeah, always a worrying suggestion from another man.
Yes, but exactly.
I did so, and he took out of a briefcase a device the size of my thumb, made of titanium. And he plugged it in and switched it on. And boy, it pumped water really well. It was a high-speed rotary blood pump, spinning it at about 8,000, 9,000 RPM. And what I said to him, I remember quite distinctly, that's a great pump for water, but it will hemolyze blood. And he said, well, it's not going to. And I said, let's see. It would be great for me to work with you on this. Why don't you let me work on it in Oxford? And I said that without having any facilities at all. I didn't have a research lab. I didn't have anything. No team to do that sort of research, but I went for it. And it transpired the only other people working with him were Houston. So I went from San Antonio to Houston to see the calves with the device in. And then I flew back to Heathrow, came to Oxford, raised philanthropically £1 million and set up a lab. And we showed that firstly, the device didn't hemolyze, didn't damage blood to a significant extent. But more unusually, all the naysayers said you cannot pump blood continuously through a high-speed pump around the body and expect a human circulation to perform the way it does with Polestar flow. Everybody believed that mammals had pulse in the circulation for a reason, and you couldn't suddenly switch that to non-pulsatile circulation. I said you can. The Americans weren't keen on trying. I did enough research, raised enough money, and persuaded the government that I should be able to try this revolutionary new type of artificial heart in humans as an alternative to heart transplantation. And that's what we did in 2000.
Wonderful. So, and in fact, you were one of the first, if not the first surgeons to implant a rotary blood pump.
I was the very first to implant a rotary blood pump on a permanent basis as an alternative to heart transplantation. On the way in that journey, as I say, Houston brought me several other pumps, including pulsatile pumps. The pulsatile pumps, like the total artificial hearts, were large, bulky affairs. They were noisy. They had big power lines coming out of the body. They were not practical. They were not patient-friendly. The small rotary blood pumps were, A, very effective, B, the patients couldn't feel them inside them, and see, they didn't damage blood anywhere near as badly as the pulsatile devices. So demonstrating that humans didn't need a pulse in the circulation was a big step. And that first patient in 2000, famous patient Peter Houghton, he was too sick for a haircut. And what's more, he had to be seen by a very eminent heart failure cardiologist who had to guarantee that he was going to die within 6 weeks. And that cardiologist came in from a conference in Europe and got to Oxford about 10 p.m. The night before the planned surgery. And we had Jarvik here, we had the Houston surgical team all ready to go, but we didn't have permission to start the whole process until about 12:30. Hmm. And it was like the man from Del Monte Says Yes, you know, he came out to Professor Philip Poole Wilson came out of Peter Houghton's room at 12:30 and said, yes, he's going to die very soon. I think you should go ahead and treat him. And the rest is kind of history. It was very difficult to get Peter through any sort of surgery, but we did. And he lived for almost 8 years and then died from kidney failure, not heart failure, mm-hmm. after a good quality of life where he actually traveled the world extolling the virtues of this type of technology.
Yes, it was a marvelous story. And in fact, you then got involved in starting an enterprise called Kalon to develop your own devices. Tell us briefly about that journey.
The problem was that everything I did with any type of pump, I had to do with philanthropic donations. The NHS wouldn't pay. And Peter Houghton, having had his quality of life, he knew that I'd implanted about 7 or 8 other patients with the Jarvik, but still the NHS wouldn't pay. So he said to me, we had a reception in 10 Downing Street one evening when Peter had...
The Prime Minister's residence, just for the benefit of those not familiar.
Peter had exceeded the previous record for anybody with an artificial heart by quite a lot. And of course, by 8 years, he was a long way ahead of anybody else. And he said to us, nobody else is getting the benefit of this type of pump because of what it costs. Why don't you make a British pump? And I had a colleague there. I never met him. Professor Mark Clement from the University of Swansea, and Peter had met him in certain contexts before, and Mark was a laser engineer with access to some really superb computer technology for computational fluid dynamics. So we put a company together, and we did a lot of very elegant basic science to design a rotary blood pump to try and improve blood handling. And eventually came up with a hybrid magnetic levitation design. The device is, again, small. It's a centrifugal pump with a radial flux gap motor. And we're working on getting rid of the power line, the power cable that comes out through the body by using induction coils and so on. We've tested this device on the bench in blood. And it certainly handles blood better to a degree than the existing devices that are used widely in the US and Europe now.
Well, all I would say is, given your history in this space, I would be highly surprised if this does not turn out to be another quantum leap in this amazing technology. You know, I don't know the numbers for the UK, but I do know that in America, thousands of people die every year because of the lack of organs for transplantation. So having something as an alternative is highly desirable. So if anyone wants to learn more, I'm going to encourage them to contact you, Steve, and I hope you will be swamped. So moving to a different topic, and I said at the beginning, I'd only touched on your achievements. You've also written books other than the technical tomes you have scribed. Two of them, Fragile Lives and The Knife's Edge, tell stories of your career. And a little plug, which you did not ask me to do, both are available from good bookstores and online and highly recommended. Tell us your favorite story from one of them.
I'm going to tell you a story from The Knife's Edge, which which may upset you, may upset everybody. When Oxford closed me down for doing too much work and spending too much money, I alluded to the fact that I went off to Riyadh. A surgeon in Riyadh had a bad back. He was the pediatric surgeon, and they desperately needed a replacement. And while I was there, I was called about a patient in Oman. And the story sort of goes that really a very beautiful Somali girl had been kidnapped and brought across to Yemen, as tended to happen in those days. And she'd been mistreated and raped, and she had a baby, and the baby got sick. And she wanted something to be done about the sick baby. She thought she was going to lose the baby and was desperately worried about it. And she walked for days through the desert to Oman and was picked up on the border in Oman, both mother and child in a terrible state. And they flew her to Riyadh. And an American cardiologist at the hospital I was working with investigated the child and found that the child had dextrocardia. The heart was in the right side of the chest, not the left side of the chest, so it twisted round. But the cause of the problem, and it was heart failure, was that there was a tumor called a rhabdomyoma in the outflow of the left ventricle. So she had an obstructed heart, basically. And the pediatric cardiologist said, "I don't think you can do anything about this." And I said, "I'm going to try, because otherwise the child's going to be dead very shortly anyway." And what I did, I knew something innovative had to be done. So I took the child to theatre and I tried to get access to this tumour with the heart in the wrong side of the chest, and it was extremely difficult. So I'd done cardiac transplants, and I decided I would take the heart out and operate it on it on the bench to remove the left ventricular outflow tract obstruction, and then I'd put it back again like a transplant. So I did that. I stopped the heart with cardioplegia solution, snipped out the heart, put it on the bench. It was not a very big heart, I have to say. It was a pediatric transplant. And then put it back again, and it worked. But the only problem, really, was that when you take out a heart and put it back again, you denervate it. So the heart rate was too slow, so I put in pacing wires to increase the heart rate. Baby went to ITU. And I was feeling very, very pleased with myself. I saw the mom and I said, "Look, I hope this has solved a very bad problem for you." And she was delighted and she was lovely. I went to bed, and the following morning I heard, whilst having breakfast in the hospital, that somebody had thrown herself off the top of the tower block with a baby in her arms. And both were dead. And when I looked into this, what I discovered was that the pacing system had got disconnected during the night. The heart was too slow, and the baby had died. And they'd put the mother in a room with the baby to sit with it for a while. The mother had taken the baby, run away, gone to the top of the tower block and finished her own life. For me, that was 200% mortality, and it's the only time in my whole career that I've ever had 200% mortality. And I'm a hard-headed guy, but that upset me. So I wanted to write about it as a testament to them, and so on, and to what it's like for mothers when their babies are ill. So that's a story from the night.
It's interesting, Steve, that you characterize yourself as hard-headed, and to be a surgeon you have to be decisive. I mean, you cannot be indecisive if you're performing surgery, but the humanity that we all as physicians deal with is really near and present, and certainly in this case. That's a very powerful story. Thank you for sharing that. And, you know, in closing, I love asking my guests this question, Steve. If you woke up tomorrow and you discover that you're Minister of Health for the world, what three things would you do to improve human health?
Obviously, you warned me about that, so I'd made a little note. I would ban smoking, which is a very preventable cause of cardiovascular disease and lung disease, and causes endless misery, and the patients always discover that too late. I think number two, you'd start to control carbon emissions better than we are doing right now if you're in government and a place of responsibility. And I think the last thing is, I believe now I would put a lot more money into cancer research right now, because I believe that in lots of cancers we are beginning to find biological, biochemical, if you like, solutions to metastatic disease. And I think just as we were in a position to control infection with the discovery of penicillin 70 years ago at the end of World War II, I think we're getting close to that in cancer. Perhaps one last point. Having been in Wuhan last December when coronavirus kicked off and there were less than 50 cases in the whole world then, I think we've got to be very, very careful about what we do in laboratories.
Well, that opens up a whole Pandora's box, if you will.
Not deliberately.
No. I know, but it's a very interesting area. Look, Steve, I'm utterly delighted you could join us today. And although you claim that you've stepped down from practice, I know that you're immensely busy. Just keep that brain of yours working. I'm sure our listeners will have been as enthralled as I have. Professor Steve Westerby, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. Please join us next Friday for the EMG Health Podcast. And until then, I'm your host, Jonathan Sakia, hoping you stay safe, stay well.